This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate Podcast, the Expert Institute, who's been there as a sponsor from the very beginning. Expert Institute is a service that both Rahul's firm and my firm use regularly to help us locate the best experts to help us work up, understand the expert issues, and to litigate and try our cases. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. Finally, our show today is sponsored by Law Pods. Law Pods is a company that specializes in helping lawyers just like us and like you create podcasts. They will help you put together the production of a podcast. So if you have an idea, if you have things you would like to share with all of us through a podcast, it's a great venue to do that. I suggest you give them a call over at Law Pods, and they'll help you come up with some ideas and put it together. Check them out at lawpods.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon.
And I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
So Rahul, big news since we last recorded. Congrats on your great verdict in Las Vegas. 8 million plus, right?
Yeah, it was an interesting case only because I never understood why we had to go try it. And I tried to reach out to the defense and see if we could resolve it. But
I have a feeling next time they might be willing to do that for you.
I hope so. But I thought with the big news, you were going to talk about Von Miller coming to the Buffalo Bills. But
I actually hadn't heard that.
What?
We don't. I
Patriot fans don't talk about that.
I'm not on all the Bills Facebook groups or whatever.
How's everything going over there?
Things are good. The major development on my end is that today starts my first day as the new Freeport High School varsity boys tennis coach, which is a position I didn't want, but I had to agree to accept because otherwise my son's tennis team would not have had a coach this season. So we'll see how that goes.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So I'm hoping we're recording a bonus episode next week, and I was thinking maybe we could use the second half of that for you to debrief us on your trial because I'm really interested in hearing more about it.
No, that sounds great.
You're the only one I know who always makes money every time you go to Vegas. And in fact, you make a lot of money there every time you go. So you got to tell us what the trick to doing that is. So we're really thrilled today to have Craig and Tony Schlaprisi from the Schlaprisi Law Firm in St. Louis, Missouri, right?
That's right.
Yes.
Okay. So I was very interested. I got word of this huge settlement you guys reached recently, and we're interested in hearing more about that. But before we do, I was also curious to see that you guys really are in a classic kind of old style family law firm, right? It's the two of you, brother, sister, and your dad. And also, I was interested to see that both of you were big-time athletes, played college sports. And Tony, I saw you played D1 college soccer, which is very impressive to me because my 14-year-old daughter plays and I've been coaching her for years. But to see what it takes to get to that level is really impressive. And I was interested. And Craig, you played football, right?
That's right, at Dartmouth.
Right. Now, I was Cornell, so I'm a little familiar with the Ivy League football. You're no schlub playing football there either. Not quite at the Von Miller level, but
that's right.
But you got to know what you're doing. So, yeah, why don't you take us back and tell us your story?
Tom, you want to start?
Sure. Well, Ben, thank you. And thank you, Rahul, so much for the opportunity to be on your podcast, Elevate. We're huge fans and of both of you. Well, our story or my story, you mentioned, Ben, sports, athletics have always been a huge part of my life. And I think for females, you know, I can only speak from the female perspective, but competitive sports are such an opportunity to really just grow in confidence. And, you know, self-esteem is always an issue. I still struggle with it. But being able to have a goal and work toward it and see yourself grow and improve and just pushing the limits of what, you know, our faith is really important to us here, of our God-given potential, and just seeing that happen and watching yourself grow and overcome. It's impossible to avoid that in sports if you stick with it. And I think it really protected me from a lot of things because I was given a gift of being somewhat athletic. I was so interested in getting better and enjoying the competition that I wasn't, you know, particularly in college, I was in New Orleans. I wasn't out partying and getting involved in things that really weren't going to serve me. Not that I didn't do some of those things, but having the sports and the team and the goals and just that aspect in college was really invaluable. And it's awesome how, you know, being an athlete and experiencing all the things you experience internally as an athlete, so much of it is transferable as a trial lawyer. You know, in trial, you experience all of the fear and thoughts and things that you may experience as an athlete, and you come up against things that are very, very similar in sports, but you're in a courtroom. And so transferring that to being able to speak and deal and learn how to be a trial lawyer is certainly a long, long life journey. But having the sports and experiencing what that involved and injuries and letdowns and then victories and teammates and lifting each other up, it just was really an incredible thing. And our dad actually was an athlete too, a great athlete. So it's been a part of our lives. And then, I mean, I want Craig to get in here, but we come from a family that's very, very close. My mom's one of 8 children. We're very, very close to all of our cousins, our uncles and aunts. Our grandfather, my mom's dad, passed away. It'll be 3 years this April. He's a huge influence in our lives even today. An incredible guy that went from rags to riches. He was a guy that sold bananas on the street and built a business from the ground up. And a bunch of our uncles work at that business now today. Just an incredible man. And it's hard not to, you know, we stand on the shoulders of everyone that's before us. It's hard not to put our head down and make something happen and be valuable given what the family that we come from. And then it's hard not to talk about our mom and dad. My mom is a radio host, an author, a public speaker, just a force, and also a very faith-filled woman. And that influence, too, is just something that we've always known. And then just growing up, hearing the stories of our dad and the clients he represented, he's been a plaintiff lawyer for, God, I don't know, 50 years. I don't know how long he's been a plaintiff lawyer.
Long time.
But an incredible man, a gentleman. And just a natural, beautiful trial lawyer. You meet him and there's something engaging and special about him. And so we've been under that umbrella since we came out of law school. And so with all of that background, we've just grown up with a love of the law and of the people that have come into our lives that we've had the privilege to represent. And so that's a bit of a background about us. Craig, please, you can fill in a little bit better than I did.
Well, Tony's being really humble. She was an incredible athlete. And I've got 3 sisters, no brothers, and I loved to play sports growing up. So Tony was the little tomboy, and we'd play basketball every day after school. We'd throw the football around, and she played, she was point guard on the basketball team. And then when she went to Tulane, it was during Katrina. That was your junior year, right? Was when Katrina hit New Orleans.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So she had some adversity there. They had to finish the season at Texas A&M. And then you finished, you graduated early. But anyways, she was a tremendous athlete and went through some serious adversity, which I think has served her really well because she's a super tough lawyer. But yeah, growing up, we grew up a very close family. our dad was constantly in trial. And I think the thing that I remember most about that growing up is we would know the client's names. So we knew, we would have prayers at the dinner table every night, and we would have specific clients that I still remember who they were and some of their stories. I don't really remember him being in trial, even though when I was like, I think 7 years old, he tried, there was a community out in just west of St. Louis called Times Beach. And they had serious dioxin contamination in the 70s and 80s. And he tried that case with some lawyers when I was maybe 7 years old. And he was in trial for 9.5 months straight on one case. But I just remember him being around all the time. So we had a wonderful, wonderful upbringing, great parents, close family. And then I went off to college, played football, really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Thought law school was kind of a natural next step, and started to really enjoy it. I would say my second year of law school, started taking some trial advocacy classes. And that's when I really kind of understood that I wanted to be a trial lawyer and represent injury victims. And that's how it all got started. I started working for my dad in college, law school, and have been doing it ever since. So that's kind of our story, I guess.
Yeah, Craig really follows in my dad's footsteps. So he tried a wrongful death case very shortly after he got his license. And every second he can get in trial, he's in trial. There's an image I always remember. It wasn't his first trial, but it was one of the early ones, one of the first 10 trials you tried. And they're in the city of St. Louis. We're downtown here in our office. So the courthouse is just a few blocks away. And it was in the middle of a recess, but Craig was standing up. It was one of those old courthouses, really pretty in the city. And he was standing up by the judge, and my dad was on the other side, but they both had an arm up on the judge's podium. And it really looked like, you know, the young and the old version of the trial lawyer. I mean, there's this tall, thin man with thick white hair on the left. And then there's this young, tall, strong man on the right with a full head of dark brown, black hair, whatever you're going to call it, Craig, on the right. And it was just really cool to see.
Used to be fuller, but yes.
From the front, maybe it's not as full. But Craig just, I think, knew that it was in his blood that he'd be a trial lawyer. I was a little different. Craig used to tease me in the beginning and tell me that there were interviews going on at all the defense firms and ask me if I wanted to go interview over there. That's changed a lot since the first year or two, but anyway, yeah.
For sure.
Has that been a hard thing for you guys to kind of start into the shadow of your dad? Obviously, he sounds like somebody who had a tremendous reputation and very skilled. That can sometimes be difficult because you wonder, can you fill those shoes? Are you going to meet those same, you know, expectations? There's the positive side, but is that also something that weighs on you a little bit?
I think so. Yeah, for sure. At the beginning, you know, there's the internal pressure. Will I live up to the reputation? Will I be any good at this? And I think one thing that really helped was our dad has been just a very unselfish mentor and somebody who never put pressure on us, who allowed us to kind of get in there. And, you know, I tried a wrongful death case essentially on my own within 6 months of passing the bar. And so he allowed us to learn, allowed us to be thrown in the fire. And I think that's how you grow. So I think it was because of the opportunities we were given to get in there, be challenged, and kind of meet that challenge or at least learn from it. And that's how you get past it. So I think there's always that, at least for trial lawyers, I think there's always that little voice inside you that wonders, am I going to be good enough? Am I, you know, when you're coming into a trial, will I say the right thing? Am I going to be good enough? And all those things. But once you get into it, as you guys know, and once you first open your mouth in front of the jury, some of those nervous tensions go away and you're just kind of in the moment, much like you would be in a game. So yeah, it's something, but luckily we've been really blessed with a tremendous mentor and opportunities to be challenged and grow and learn and that's really helped.
Yeah, I agree. My dad has always said, Craig's right. He is one of the most selfless people that I've ever known. He's not jealous or covetous of anything. The moment we walked in the doors, we were able to work on cases that we really, I don't think most lawyers at that age are not, or at that level of experience are able to be a part of. And he's always enforced to us that, you know, you can learn from others, you can admire others, but you have to find your voice, your style. You may not have as much experience as that guy or this guy or this gal or that gal, but you're just as good. And he's always said that and believed it. He's not. And as a daughter, I think maybe it's a little different for me than maybe Craig as a son. I've always just felt full support and belief in me and, you know, with his reputation and what he's done and the kind of man and the integrity in which he's practiced. We came in with so much value with his reputation preceded us. And so we automatically were given credibility. So having to live up to that is certainly something that we understand and know. But I think he's just an unusual mentor in that sense, that he wants us to fully come into our own and give us the confidence to do it.
What are a couple of the things that your dad taught you about being a trial lawyer that you still use today?
The biggest one, obviously, is preparation, to be prepared for everything. I think also what he taught us about opening statement is you open with something. It's almost like the, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. The famous trial lawyer out of Texas who always talks about opening with a hook. Well, I'll remember. But anyway.
Joe Jermail?
Not Joe Jermail. Oh, man. I'll remember it.
Anyway, there's so many out of Texas. It's hard to keep track of them.
So many.
Yeah.
Anyways, to open with a hook Lanier? And tell a compelling story. What's that?
I thought you were talking about Lanier.
No.
Possibly.
He's a great one. There's a lot, like Ben said, there's a lot out of Texas. But with opening, to open with a hook and tell a compelling story. That's always stuck with me and something he's always done. I remember I would read some of his old transcripts in opening statement, and he was doing this was he did. He's done a lot of medical malpractice work and a lot of medical malpractice trials. And he was talking about it was a birth injury case he had tried, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago before Rules of the Road had come out. And he was comparing the standard of care and things a doctor should or doing should or shouldn't do to a stop sign in the road, things like that. Always the power of analogy. So those are some of the takeaways. But maybe the biggest thing I've taken away from him is you have to love your client. You just have to care about them. He's always, always been involved, especially in the bigger cases, always been involved in their lives, always taken time to go to a client's home to get to know their family. I mean, he talks to them on a daily basis. So I think the biggest takeaway for me from him has been you have to know and love your client if you're going to effectively represent them in front of a jury.
Yeah, my dad once said to me, and I'll never forget it. He said, never lose sight of the fact that we make our living off of the tragedies of others. And, you know, I didn't know where to go with that. And then I reflected on it for some time. And, you know, I realized, and you all, Rahul and Ben, you know, I mean, tragedy comes. We don't ask for it. It's going to come. It just does. And when it does, we are here. You know, it's not something we ask for. We want to enter other people's lives, but it does. And there's a justice system there. And we're trained and skilled in that, and our hearts are wired for it. And so, but I think he said that to me because, you know, there's so much now that we're exposed to and that we see, and we're all connected as trial lawyers. And there's a level of, we can get caught up in, am I as good as them? Or am I as good? And things that don't matter. And if we can come back to the truth, the big truth of what we're doing and why we're doing it. You know, people have suffered a lot, and it's our job to make sure they get everything that they can under our system that they're entitled to. And I, it's not popular to talk about losing, but I've learned a lot from him on how to gracefully lose. And I think when you, and we thank God been very successful here at this firm, but if you try cases, you're going to lose cases. You're going to lose some cases. And I may have learned more from my father with all of the successes that he's had from seeing how he courageously loses a case. I mean, we tried a very difficult case in a difficult county years ago, and we lost. It was a child, a birth injury case. And those are really hard to lose because they really need the compensation for their lives. And my dad didn't sleep for 3 weeks, maybe 2 hours a night. He was standing up on his feet every single day in that courtroom. Same guy I know that I've known my whole life. And we had, you know, it took a long time to pack up everything you've got for a 3 week trial. And we were driving back to St. Louis. This is a couple hours away. He was beat up by it. That was obvious. But there was some kind of strength about him. And it was clear to me how this had to have been done. Yes, we could go back and do it differently. We would if we could. But to see, you know, I think in this work, you have to really be convicted and believe in what you're doing, because you're going to get, there's going to be those times where you lose and it really, really sucks. But seeing how he handles that, and Craig too, Craig has always said, because on those times where you lose, he said, look, you're going to try cases. You're actually be a trial lawyer. You're going to lose cases. So, you know, Craig can be tough on that. But for me, that's good to know, because with a loss, I can start thinking about, you know, well, should I be doing this? Is this the right thing to be doing? I question a lot. And Craig's really quick to say, get in there and try the hard cases. But, you know, you learn a lot from a seasoned lawyer that, you know, has seen a lot of success when they lose a case. And it teaches you a lot as a young person. So for me, when I saw that in my dad, that taught me a lot. He's also very creative. He says you have to be creative in every case. And when you get a bad blow or a bad break in a case, you know, he's like, well, you know, that's why you're a lawyer. You've got to look at this at the different perspective. And so just teaching us to pivot and be creative, he's taught us a lot about that, and just about how to, just integrity and in the practice too. Didn't think we'd be talking so much about our dad, but he's such a big influence on us.
He's also told us there's no certain way to do something. To have innovation, when you cross-examine someone, try to come from a different angle. There's no necessarily right way to do it, but show some creativity and some ingenuity and be confident. And that's been a big lesson for me, especially with cross-exam.
Yeah, and he always says with cross-exam, you know.
The lawyer I was trying to think of, Jim Perdue, it came to me.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's a great one. So you guys, one or both of you mentioned faith as being an important aspect in your lives. I think you mentioned praying at the dinner table and mentioning clients in that setting. I'm just interested in that because as a trial lawyer, I know in some circles, faith can kind of enter the courtroom. A lot of the famous trial movies, there's allusions to the Bible or references like that. And I'm just curious. So where I live in New England, although some people do have lots of, they're devoted to their faith, people tend to be much less willing to talk openly about faith in public settings. You probably would not do that in a courtroom because it would be well received, but only by a minority of the jurors probably in New England. So I'm just curious, but I know, for example, down south, it's regularly invoked. So I'm interested in how faith relates to your trial practice. And is that something that you're not just doing at home, but is also makes its way in some respect into the trial process or into the courtroom?
Well, I would say it is definitely in the background. We're Catholics. The rosary is a very powerful prayer in our faith that we say pretty much every day, but especially during trial, for all the help that we can get to make sure we're our very best and we do God's justice. I would say in trial, when it comes to especially closing argument. I have not used faith so much in argument. We've talked about how being in a courtroom is a sacred place. And, you know, I stole this from a trial lawyer, I can't remember which one, but that, you know, there's very few sacred places. One is our homes, the others are churches, and the third would be our courtrooms. So to refer to it in that sense, but it hasn't, I think it can be, as long as you're authentic, I think it's okay. But at the same time, you can be a little too overt with it, which might turn jurors off. But I think, at least for us, and in my experience, that as long as you're authentic and it comes from a real place, then the jurors will appreciate and pick up on that. What do you think, Tony? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I 100% agree. It really doesn't enter into the words we're speaking in trial, but the process in our office, we pray for our clients, we pray for their families, we pray for opposing counsel sometimes when they're interfering with what I need to do. Experts, even in the midst of depositions, I might be saying a prayer because you know when there's important moments. And often in trial, there'll be a rosary in my pocket. But as far as, I think Craig's right, it's more of just who we are inherently, what's a part of us, what we believe in. It's very much aligned with the work that we do. You know, we believe in the value and dignity of every human life. And that's what plaintiff trial lawyers believe in. And so our faith only complements that and helps us realize that. So I think it just is a part of what's inside of us. But I've also never referred to the Bible or anything faith-based when speaking to a jury. It's just part of my makeup.
Tony said she prays for the defense lawyer sometimes, but she can also be really mean, guys. I'll tell you that. she can be very, yeah, very mean sometimes. I remember we were in trial. This was the one a few years ago, the birth injury case, and we were doing something with opposing counsel, and we were trying to get an agreement. I go, look, guys, if we don't agree to this, I'm just going to go get Tony, and she's going to take over. And they go, no. We'll agree to it. Just don't get your sister. So she looks nice and seems nice, yeah, but can be very mean.
Yeah, I can be very mean. Yeah. But I'm working on my temper. But anyway, it's not coming across right now, thank God.
Well, you have to transfer the midfield defender in you into the trial process, right?
Right. That's right. Right. Yes.
So do you guys handle most of your cases together? And then if that is the case, how do you complement each other?
We've got an associate lawyer and then the three of us. So we'll each kind of be assigned our own cases and work them up, and we'll collaborate along the way. But when we're in trial, we try all our cases together. And it's, to me, a tremendous, tremendous benefit. And depending on, I think your last guest talked about this, kind of the lawyers and their different skill sets complementing each other. So Tony and I tried a case actually in Cleveland a couple of years ago with an Ohio lawyer who's a friend of ours. And Tony, were you 8 months pregnant during that trial?
I was like a little less than 8 months. I was like 7.5 months or something like that.
Well, you could definitely tell she was pregnant. So in that case, I was really close with the client. And I did jury selection because I enjoy it, and I think it's something I'm pretty good at. Tony did opening because she's excellent at opening statement. I directed the client and a lot of the damages witnesses because I was close to them. And then Tony cross-examined some defense experts, and I cross-examined the defendant physician. And then I did the first part of closing, and my friend in Ohio, Charlie Rickers, did rebuttal close. But so we always kind of break it up that way. And the way we would handle it with a client is whoever is closest to that client is going to be the one to do their direct exam. And we usually split up the rest of trial in the way I just described. Tony will do opening, I'll do jury selection. Sometimes I'll do jury selection and open, and we'll flip it. But I think Tony's got a wonderful grasp of any aspect of expert testimony that might be in the case. If it's medicine or engineering. She's extremely thorough. So she can piece by piece kind of attack the experts in whatever that area is. So she's very good in those specialized areas. And then as far as closing goes, again, I would say that whoever really knew the client the most would do the rebuttal close and kind of bring it home in that aspect. And that's kind of always, so it's not always the same, but it is definitely a collaborative effort. In fact, we try cases. We have a cousin in town. We have a big family. We have a cousin in town, Chris Finney, who's our age. And it's just a phenomenal trial lawyer. And we try a lot of cases with him. In fact, we've got one coming up, a truck crash death case and injury case in a few months. We'll be trying with him. So we collaborate a lot, and it's been very effective in my experience, I think.
Do you have any other siblings?
Yeah, we've got two. Tony's a twin.
Yeah, I'm a twin. Yeah. We're not identical.
Oh, wow.
But she's a few inches taller than me and a nurse, and she's in Dallas, Texas now. But she's actually helped us a lot in the law. She's, especially in the medical cases, the malpractice cases, she's taught me a lot. I mean, she spent hours with me teaching me about metabolic acidosis and how to figure out different things. She's really bright, and she has an incredible heart, Tina. But our older sister, Annie, is a lawyer also, but not in injury work. Craig mentioned these collaborating and trying cases together. It really is a tremendous help. He often gets pulled in. He mentioned our cousin to try cases with other folks. And he can go into a trial just, you know, a week before or know well in advance. But he's a really huge value. And our cousin would say that too, on any aspect of trial, whether he's just helping you with jury selection and giving you advice in between breaks as far as such and such, or he'll take on all the challenges for cause and peremptories, and just has a very confident, quiet, but strong way about him in a courtroom. And he mentioned Ohio, but that actually was from Craig's Dartmouth days. Ben, you know, he has very good friends from his team, his football team, and Charlie Rickers is one of them. So Craig, you have a lot of friendships. I mean, Craig's in a very difficult, but important case in San Antonio, Texas, because of a good friend of his who passed away in a plane crash. And he's in Ohio a lot because of Charlie, and he's in California, actually, Rahul, because of a friendship here in St. Louis for a negligent security shooting case. But what I've seen with Craig has been the one that I've seen how effective it can be to try cases with multiple lawyers. I know there are some people who are of the thinking that one lawyer should try the case from start to finish, and that might be the right thing to do in certain cases, you know, one mentor throughout the whole case for the jury to become aligned with. Maybe because we're related and we have a lot of the same value systems and we're brother and sister, father, daughter, there's a connection there that stays throughout. But it is very helpful to have different styles try a case. And it is often what Craig says. He has a great connection with jurors. So in jury selection, he's often picking the jury and he's often closing. And Craig, I think you would say that if you pick the jury, you should at least participate in one portion of closing, right? I mean, don't you think that's the case?
I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you. Yes, for sure.
Why do you think that, Craig?
I think the connection that starts in jury selection, I think having that initial connection is very effective and helpful when you're arguing to the jury. Yeah, I think it's all about the connection. So I think it's important that when you do your summation, that you have someone who from the get-go, from that journey through trial, had started with them. I think it really helps. What do you guys think?
Well, yeah, you know, I agree with both of you and am of the philosophy that it's okay to have more than one lawyer involved in a trial, and it can be very helpful and you can complement each other. At the same time, though, I'm always concerned that there's a potential to have too many lawyers in a particular trial, and then that can dilute your ability to connect. So it's interesting to hear the dynamic between you two and you know, that that similarity sort of complementing each other and aligning with each other to keep that connection with the jury and still having that conscious desire to maintain that connection with the jury, which I think is important.
Absolutely.
So I think there does have to be a match between who is trying the case together to make sure you have that that connection and maintain it.
For sure.
I agree with your thought, Craig. I think when you begin developing a relationship with a jury and voir dire, and you often will reference subjects or themes that you're going to, you intend to return to in your close. And in your close, you remind them that you had had this discussion in voir dire. I do think that full circle can be helpful. I'm curious, Raul is known kind of nationwide as a leader on voir dire and often presents on that subject at seminars, but I know it's different in every state in terms of what you're allowed to do and approach. What is your approach, Craig, in, when you do voir dire? Are you trying to primarily exclude bad jurors? Are you trying to connect with jurors? How do you approach it?
Well, I don't know if I'm in the same class as Rahul, but I'm trying to live up to him. That's for sure. I would say, we are very fortunate in Missouri because you have wide latitude in jury selection. And really, you can take as much time as you want. So in a big case, you could have a 2-day jury selection if a judge will allow it. And typically they will. So we're very fortunate. In my experience, and I know there's a lot of different opinions, in my experience, I think connection is the most important part of jury selection. So I would say, yes, we want to identify biased jurors and those who are going to be bad for us. But I think the number one most important thing is connection and being open. And a lot of it is the Nick Rowley philosophy, who I know you guys know and have had on the show. I would say that I try to mimic that. Connect with the jury, be open to those folks, and then be prepared if you have to challenge someone for bias, be prepared to do it. And we have done a lot of work with John and Alicia Campbell. I know you guys have had on the show as well. And I think that Empirical Jury is just an unmatched service. I think it's wonderful. And we've used them maybe 6 or 7 cases. We've got them in a couple right now. And they've been really, really helpful with identifying those folks who you may need to be leery of in jury selection. But that's a long way of saying, Ben, that I think that my philosophy, what's worked best for me and may not be true of others, but is trying to connect with those folks. I think it's really helpful. For me, it's a lot more freeing in jury selection. You know, when I first got started, I was so worried about, can I say this? Can I say that? What if someone, you know, aunt asks me a question or says this, how do I respond? And it's just been so much more, there's so much more freedom if you just accept those folks and try to, you know, it's lofty words, try to love those people and connect with them. It just, the discussion and the connection has been so much better for me in jury selection, if that makes sense.
When you're saying connect, how do you connect with different jurors?
Number one, I think, is listening. I remember a case, and this is an example of not listening, where the defense lawyer was questioning one of the members on the panel. And this guy brought up the fact that his brother was robbed. I think he was a pizza delivery guy, and he was robbed and murdered. And the defense lawyer said, oh, okay, thanks, and then moved on to the next person and didn't do anything to acknowledge this man's loss, didn't do anything to acknowledge what was palpable emotion in the room, because he wasn't listening and he didn't care. So I think that you can do it the way, for me, that it's worked best, Rahul, is listening to people, actively listening, and being able to sit there. Sometimes it's hard for me to sit in silence because all of a sudden everyone's looking at you and it can be kind of awkward, but being able to sit there in silence and accept what someone is giving you and actively listening and reflect what they're saying. And also being honest. I've had times where We've had people who are so clearly biased against the defense, which is pretty unusual, I think, at least in my experience, where we've said, hey, you, it doesn't seem like you can give a fair shake to the other side. I mean, is that, do you think this might not be the best case for you? So being authentic, honest, and actively listening, I think, helps establish that connection, my experience.
We want to thank our sponsors for the Elevate podcast. And Ben, I want to start with Steno. Steno's a court reporting agency that is really technology-based and now all over the country. One of the most fantastic things about them, in my opinion, is not only are they able to cater the deposition experience and especially remote experiences to whatever your needs are, but for plaintiff trial lawyers, contingency lawyers, who don't get paid per hour, but get paid perhaps, and they do things on a non-recourse base, so they don't get paid until you actually get a recovery for your client. And if you don't get a recovery for your client, they don't get paid at all. And so it allows you to actually feel free to take as many depositions as you feel are necessary on your cases without having any unnecessary outside influences pushing you.
Yeah, that's a great deal. I'm checking them out. I know you guys use them a lot and we're thinking about starting. That is a very appealing part of the deal that you don't have to pay for the court reporter unless and until you recover money in the case. Too bad all the vendors don't work that way. So we're also sponsored by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a firm started by two of our friends, Micah and Tyler. They did all the graphics for our Elevate podcast, which are fantastic. They do really great work. I had worked with them for at least a decade when they were at High Impact making trial graphics. I was sad that they left High Impact, but really happy that they started their own company helping lawyers who want to enhance their digital marketing and web profiles. So if you're interested in that, I would check them out.
Good guys and really good work product coming out of them too.
I'll tell you a little secret. The time that I got hooked on High Impact was when I was out in Denver for some depositions and Tyler took me fly fishing for the day. He's actually an exceptional fisherman and we had a great day out on the river. I think I caught one brown trout. We weren't catching a lot of fish, but it was just really great to be out there. So maybe if you hire them, they'll take you fly fishing too.
Oh, that's fantastic. And for all the other vendors out there, if you want Ben's business, take them fly fishing.
We appreciate Boondoggles. That's very helpful in securing our loyalty. So we're also sponsored by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is a case management software for trial lawyers. It's this program that we use. They actually just updated their graphical interface. I really like the new look. It's really fantastic. It's web-based. It's subscription-based, so you pay by the user. So it scales up depending on the size of your business. So check them out, smartadvocate.com. Tony, I'm interested in your, it sounds like you're the heavy to some extent where you come in and do the cross of the difficult defense experts and some of the technical issues in the cases. And I'm interested in how you approach that, what your style is, but also if you have any thoughts about whether being a woman lawyer creates an advantage or disadvantage in that setting. And do you feel like, because I'm just picturing, I do a lot of medical cases, you have these old white-haired males that are often very arrogant as experts, and they see you coming. Is that an advantage to you, a disadvantage? What do you think?
Yeah, and Craig crosses those experts too, but I have always felt being a female was an advantage. I really do. I think I'm always underestimated. My dad walks into a room, Craig walks into a room, they're not underestimated, you know, and I am. And so folks aren't expecting me to be prepared. They're not expecting me to know the medicine, and they're really not expecting me to be tough. And I think that that is a huge advantage. When crossing or handling anyone, whether it's in a deposition or trial, I mean, I think I approach it in different ways. I'm a bit anal. So I'm very, very, I want to know everything. about the case, about that person that I'm talking to. But beyond just the technicalities of their opinions in the case, I want to understand who they are as a human being too. I think with everyone that I am deposing or dealing with at trial, I have one or two purposes that I have in my mind. This is what I need from this person. And it helps me stay focused, and because you can be taken off in one direction or another. But if you know this is the one point or the two points that I must get out of this person, and that's it, that's all I need, that's very helpful for me, because I can get so bogged down in the details and on tangents. As a female, and because I'm a mom, there is a limitation that I have that you don't have as a man, at least in the world that I've grown up in. You know, I want to be present to my children. I have three kids. My little girl, my youngest, has some special needs. I'm pregnant with my fourth, and I want a big family. I also very much want to be a trial lawyer. But with that comes some realities that I can't be doing what Craig's doing all of the time. I can't be in trial all the time. I can't travel to Texas, to California, to Ohio all the time. It's important to me that I'm here for my children too. And so, but there are a lot of opportunities we have as women to still be trial lawyers. And, you know, there's a part of me that's, I want to pick the jury. I want to be doing that. But, you know, I will when that time comes. And to prepare right now in the season of my life for that, while I'm not going to be Craig and I can only be Tony, there are opportunities. You can do focus groups where you stand up and you start trying to do a Boyd Dyer. I have a couple folks that we're getting together in MATA, Missouri Association of Trial Attorneys. We're going to get together once a month and stand up and just feel the awkwardness, because a lot of that stimulation is the same thing you're going to feel in front of in trial. And just exposing myself to that as often as I can. You know, I've made a commitment that every month I'm going to read at least one trial book. I'm going to stand up in front of a group and practice a voir dire. I'm going to make myself feel awkward and uncomfortable and feel what that feels like and expose myself. I'm going to watch a trial if it's not our trial that I'm involved in. I'm going to be in the courtroom and feel everything. There's ways. I think that women maybe, there might be a wall in the way of women wanting to be involved and being particularly a plaintiff trial lawyer. I think it is so aligned with what women, I mean, we're nurturing, we love, we're connected, and we can bring a lot to the profession. Thankfully, I've been in a family and in a law firm that allows me to be me, that allows me to be with my children and my family and still practice. But I wanted to mention that, Ben, because just because I may not be involved in as many trials, we have a lot of opportunities to put ourselves in the same type of situation as if we're in trial, so that we're ready when the time comes. And even virtual opportunities, you know, Sari De La Motte has that H2H crew, and there's a lot of opportunities to practice voir dire there. But I do think there is something to being in a room with others and be present and feeling that. And that's something that we have as women. But to answer your question, I think it's a huge benefit to be a female. I think everyone underestimates you, and that's a way to get a lot done very quickly and surprisingly.
Yeah, I'm taking away that it would be a huge mistake to underestimate Tony.
Oh,
absolutely.
So could we talk a little bit about your recent settlement? So you guys got a monster settlement recently that we became aware of, and I know there's some limitations on what you can say about it and what you can't, but I'm told you can say the amount. So $37.5 million, incredible work. What can you tell us about the case?
Well, it was a products case. It was a defective tire, and essentially it was manufacturing defects. So we represented a young man who's driving a dump truck. He's going from a work site back to the yard. when on the highway at highway speed, 65 miles an hour, when his right front steer tire catastrophically fails. He goes off the highway about 150 feet and hits a tree in horrific damage. I mean, the front of the truck was nearly taken off. He was pinned between the seat and the steering wheel, and it took 45 minutes for emergency crews to get him out and helicopter him to a hospital. He ended up losing his right leg above the knee, horrific, horrific left frontal lobe brain injury. Frankly, it's a miracle that he lived. I think he was 30 years old at the time. He was not married, no kids. So what we had to do, we got involved in the case early on. And fortunately for the case, because of that, we were able to preserve the tire. We were able to preserve the vehicle. And we had to, Tony and I had to get a conservator and a guardian appointed because he obviously couldn't make decisions on his own. So we went through probate court. We did that. At the same time, we had found, we found two tire experts. One, luckily, we found one of the best in the country and started to get that going. After that, we had been talking to a lawyer who's now a very dear friend who had handled, he's handled a lot of tire cases, and he had a case specific to this tire. His name's Ben Baker, and he's with Beasley Allen out of Montgomery, Alabama. So Ben, you guys may know him, phenomenal guy, tremendous trial lawyer and a very dear friend. And we started to talk to Ben about the case as we were going through these steps. And eventually Tony and I were just talking. We're like, we got to bring Ben in on this case. And it was, I think, one of the best decisions we made. And we ended up just, you always have a little bit of fear that if you bring another lawyer in a case who you don't necessarily know, you may lose some control. If this, you know, if we're going to try this case, I wanted to do jury selection. I wanted to be involved in opening, close, all these things. And it just was a beautiful partnership with Ben. And we essentially just split the work and expenses right down the middle. And we got cracking. And, you know, long story short, the case was set to be tried this past October. And we had we'd gotten through all the expert depositions, and it was one of those cases where, you know, the client, he should have died, and he lived. And not only did he live, he started to get better. Miraculously, he was able to start eating on his own. He had one of the saddest parts of the case was he understood who he was before and understood that he was hurt, which was devastating. And he started to be able to communicate a little bit. He would remember who I was. He had his cousin, who was his first cousin, his older cousin, who was a guardian angel, who became his guardian, who visited him all the time, who made sure he was clean and safe. And so the case just started to really come together. Our experts, I thought, were far superior. You know, we're taking depositions, and I'm deposing a PM&R doctor for the defense, who we see in soft tissue cases, who does injections of, you know, shoulders and knees, and hadn't taken care of a brain injury patient in 30 years. And you're like, you know, and the guy we had, the life care planner, was the treating PM&R physician, board certified, had been taking care of brain injury patients for decades. So the experts kind of came together. We had really, really powerful OSI evidence involving the same tire. The tire did not meet the manufacturer's own internal specifications for inner liner thickness. So it just started to come together. And we had, there was insurance money. It was not a manufacturer's money. And there was a limited policy. From the work we did with John and Alicia Campbell, we knew that this case was very, very, very strong and very high value, and punitive damages were a serious consideration for the defense. So we just hung in there. And I think what we got from, at least what I got from John and Alicia's focus group, was the confidence to turn down really, really serious offers. We mediated twice and walked and eventually said that unless we get all remaining coverage, we're not settling this case, and we're going to try the case. And we got to a point where they said, you know, they said uncle, and we were able to get the case resolved for all of the available insurance coverage and get our client, who was still involved in his life, you know, everything that he needed to at least have all the medical care, the best medical care in the country, and everything he needs to be able to thrive with his condition. I think that about sums it up.
Wow. That's a fantastic result. Congrats.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your client was lucky to have you guys.
Well, I don't know about that, but we, it was a collaborative effort, and it was the partnership with Ben Baker and friendship has just been awesome. It just that the everything in the case came together. You know, that rarely happens, at least in my experience, where just everything comes together. Usually, you know, there's something bad that's going to happen. It was a great result for him. So we're proud to represent him for sure.
No, that's great. Those are tough cases too.
Ben and Rahul, there were, Craig said, there were some tough things that did happen, that they always do. But I think Craig would visit him all the time. Where he was at the time. He's going to be able to move in with his family now, but you know, he was in a home and prayed for him all the time. But I mean, there were times when he got sick, he was worried about whether or not he was going to make it and things like that. But Craig, he said that John Campbell, Alicia Campbell, that there, the way that they focused this and gave him, you know, as far as value, gave him a lot of confidence. But I think a lot goes to Craig as far as when he decides what the value of the loss is in a case, you're not going to change his mind. And it's not a foolish thing. It's just it's a huge asset in a case. And when you have someone with that kind of confidence, I think you turn down a $25 million offer. That's hard to do in any case. And I think because of how he knew the client so well, of course he'd have done the work focusing, and he had been involved in every step of the way in the workup, there was a confidence. But I think there was still also, there's got to be always that fear. And he, instead of listening to that, he listened to something that was stronger, a stronger strength. And we've learned that here, Craig, when we've talked about when we're in negotiations, because we've done it wrong before, that we're never going to negotiate in fear. And if someone's feeding us fear, we're not going to respond until that's been discarded from us, because it's just not the place to be if you're going to get the most just result. You can't be in a place of fear. And whatever you need to do to get out of that place of fear, you have to do, whether that's to focus group it, study the case more, or be more realistic about value. But because of him,
sure,
they were not going to just pay the limits in this case. That was certainly not on the table. And there were many times I doubted it, and he stuck to his guns and he did what he needed to for this young man. So pretty incredible.
Yeah.
That, well, it's a great result. And we really appreciate you guys coming on today. This was fantastic. Great conversation. I think it'll have a lot of value to our listeners. So much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you guys. Yeah,
thank you.
I think I've listened to every episode. So I know the kind of lawyers that you two are. So it's been really fun for me, and really a privilege to hang out with you guys for an hour or so. So we appreciate it.
Yeah.
Likewise.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.